Six Music.
Telling the stories in music that matter. Now, Six Music documentaries present Master Tapes.
Well, if there's something that I like, it's the way that woman walk. If there's something I like better, it's the way she baby talk. She does it right.
Tapes. That's Wilco Johnson playing for our audience here at the Maid of Vale Studios. In the first part of this programme, Wilco discussed Down by the Jetty, the 1975 debut album by Dr. Feelgood, which included She Does It Right, All Through the City, and of course, Roxette.
I saw you out the other night. I saw somebody hold you tight.
In the first part, we heard how, after studying Anglo-Saxon and Norse literature at university and heading off on the hippie trail to India, Wilco returned home to Canvey Island in Essex. It was there, in the shadow of the oil refineries, that he formed Dr. Feelgood in 1971. Wilco also told us about his experience of being diagnosed with terminal cancer and why he's refused to undergo chemotherapy treatment, opting instead to hit the live circuit and say goodbye to his fans, as he's doing here with us on Master Tape. In the second part of the programme, the B-side, it's the turn of our studio audience to ask the questions. Before we get those questions, most of the people here at Maid of Vale, Wilco, are hardcore fans of yours. How important are these people to you? What has your relationship been like with your audience over these years?
I don't know, it's a strange thing. I mean, I don't suffer from it so much now, but certainly in the early days, I really used to suffer from stage fright. And you would give £1,000 not to step out on that stage. And you're thinking, what's the matter? These people have all paid money to see you. They all obviously really dig you and that. But you cannot look on them as friends. You know, you're certain they're going to tear you to pieces. I don't know. I must say that after I'd received this, the diagnosis, it's great the way people thrash around for euphemisms about this. They go, you're condition. What, you mean cancer? Yeah. The first thing I did actually was go for 2 weeks in Japan, because I love it in Japan, and I came home with a carrier bag full of letters that people had given me. And then a few nights later, I was reading through them. I'll tell you what, it was really touching, because every one of these letters was expressing personal affection for me. I mean, you know, I knew we were very popular out there, and people like the music and everything, you know, bit of a star, big in Japan, you know. But these letters were expressing this personal affection. I must admit, it even touched a tough guy like me. So I really don't know what my relationship is. You know, it's a kind of mixture of terror and affection, I think.
Well, let's crack on with our first question. And it comes from Sarah Bates from Birmingham. Sarah.
Wilco, hi. You've already talked about how you felt when you recorded the album, about the way it was recorded, and your feelings towards mono and stereo. How did the band feel at the time, and how did you get them on side with you? And then how did you as a group go to your producer and persuade him?
Well, on the first day, I just threw a wobbler. And basically, it terrified our manager. He had to go and tell the producer, listen, Wilco ain't going to do it your way. He wants to do it. And that's what they had to do. I left him with the dirty work of telling the poor guy. And I don't think the rest of the band were in a mood to argue with me.
It was your way or no way.
Oh, I think so.
And Sarah, you think the album benefits from the way it's... And just to explain, we heard about it in the first part of the programme, that the album was recorded more or less live and then all the tracks mixed down to give a mono effect. I mean, that's the way you liked it, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yeah. It just sounded as if they were there in front of us, so it's the perfect way to do it. And thank you.
Thank you.
Next question comes from Phoebe Pisa-Lyles, who describes herself as... 18-year-old art and design student who wishes she has a time machine to take her back to the music of the late 70s. That's
so
right,
am I.
Phoebe.
A lot of punk bands in later years cited Dr. Feelgood as an influence. Did you ever consider yourself part of the punk movement at the time or in hindsight?
Well, we were touring America largely in 1976, so that whole punk thing was happening while we were away. Then shortly after that, I find myself ejected from Dr. Feelgood and thinking, well, I wonder what all these new people are going to make of me. I was walking in Oxford Street. Joe Strummer came running out of the crowd. He went, you don't know who I am. But I said, I know you are, man. I've seen you in the newspaper. And he's going, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. But anyway, let's get together. I said, look, come over to West Hampstead. I've got a flat in West Hampstead. Come over to West Hampstead and we'll all have, you know, have an afternoon. So he said, yes. Yeah. So when I got back to West Hampstead, I found Lemmy there.
Lemmy from Motorhead.
Yes. I said, oh, man, I met this guy from The Clash, right? And they're coming up. He went, The Clash. He said, do you hear what their roadie said about our last single? I went, oh. And it must be, but I thought, and it might be quite good. You're having Motorhead and The Clash having a punch up in your front room. But actually, we all got on very, very well. And I did gradually get to know all of these people. And in fact, they had all seen Dr. Feelgood and taken a clue from Dr. Feelgood. But of course, when you're up there doing it, you're not really aware of people down in the front taking notes.
So many people, yeah. So many of that generation did cite the Feelgoods as an influence. Not just Joe Strummer, but John Lydon as well. Yeah. And Paul Weller in particular, you hear it right the way through the first Jam album, that yeah. guitar style. And when you started hearing that music, did you hear elements of yourself?
When Feelgood started succeeding, I thought, this is going to lead to a big rhythm and blues boom, just like the Rolling Stones created in the 60s. But in fact, that didn't happen, because in fact, most of the people that were in those punk bands were very young and very inexperienced and simply technically weren't up to it, right? But what they did learn off Dr. Feelgood was that you can make an exciting show with very, very simple elements if you just throw yourself body and soul into it. That, combined with the whole fashion thing, which was obviously nothing to do with us, you know, we didn't have safety pins and green hair and that. That was their invention.
It's funny, actually, because you're answering a question from Phoebe on the front row, who's got a safety pin around her neck. He's wearing the regulation tartan trousers, and it's not green hair, but it's dyed hair. And Phoebe, you're only 18 years old. Yeah. You love all of that style, all of that music. Yeah. That's why you want that time machine.
Yeah.
I'll see you there.
But it ended pretty badly with the band, didn't it? Because you were thrown out as you're recording the fourth album, and you never really properly made up with Lee Brillo before he died.
No, I didn't. It's a shame, but that's the way life goes.
Did you ever meet again?
Not really. We bumped into each other once or twice, but it was usually just embarrassing. You know, you're both standing there kind of looking at your shoes going, you all right? And you go, yeah, all right, you know, all right. And there were a couple of occasions when the band could have got back together, but it didn't happen. I remember once I was in London and a friend of mine came to where we were and said, hey, guess who I've been talking to? I say, what? He said, I've been talking to Lee Brillo. He said, I'll tell you what, I think he would like to get back together. And he said, I took the liberty of arranging a meeting in the Ship in Wardour Street for tomorrow, you and Lee. Will you do it? And I started thinking, I thought, yeah, Yeah, I think I will. Let's get Dr. Feelgood back together, because it was silly breaking up.
And what year was this? How long
ago? This would have been 1977, a few months after the bust up. And, well, I met this girl, and I just couldn't tear myself away from her for about 36 hours, so I missed the meeting. That was that.
These people in this room are not going to forgive you for that story. Another question. This one's from Karen Rutherford, who describes herself as a true 70s girl from Suffolk.
It's obvious that your music is strongly influenced by your life on Canvey, with your family and your friends, but do you think this actually dictated the path to Dr. Feelgood and your resulting career, or do you think you chose your own path?
The thing to do, if you're writing a song, even if it is about a real person or an event, if it makes a better song, lie. Make it up, invent it, you know, like, you don't need to be true. And I think that it's the music that dictates what sounds good, you know. And I did used to try and incorporate the landscape of Canvey Island, if you like. It was just all part of our fantasy.
We heard it in the opening line of All Through the City, and there are other specific references, not just on this album, but in other songs that you've written throughout your career, to the landscape, to your upbringing on Canvey.
There's a song called Paradise. In fact, that is the only song where I've used a proper name, because when I was writing the song, the name Irene, which is my wife's name, came up, and so I used her name in this, and that song is very autobiographical, if you like. Well, I went out walking, I recall, me and my best girl along the wall, in the long grass, side by side, where the big ships go gliding by, skylarks singing in the sun. Something told me she's the one. When I looked down into her eyes, I saw pictures of paradise, of paradise, of paradise. So mean, staring at your TV screen. Back when we were 17, you turn me round, Irene, Irene.
Reference in the song there to her being 17. Of course, you met as kids, didn't you? Childhood sweetheart.
We were indeed childhood sweethearts.
Where did you meet?
Down the youth club.
And then watching, as the song says, watching the big ships gliding by.
Yeah, well, that's over the end of the island where the refinery is. It's all open there, you know, the sea wall. That's where you could go with your girlfriend to discuss
life, yeah, the universe and everything.
Exactly, where the big ships go gliding by.
Our next question comes from Kerry Elliott, who's emailed in from Canvey Island. She says, we've held several memorial events to mark 60 years since the Great Flood of 1953. You, Wilco, would have been 5 years old at the time. Do you have any memory of that terrible night?
I do indeed. I can remember being hustled up very early in the morning, looking out of the back window of our house, which was normally a field. So Canvey Island was almost rural then. Instead of seeing fields, seeing the waves, the sea was actually washing up to our house. You could see waves and that. And I, clever little kid, I realised what was going on, you know. But I remember being heartily impressed by seeing the beach actually come walking towards our back door. The whole island was evacuated. The army came in and everything. We were all taken up to this school up on the mainland. A school actually where some 20 years later, I was briefly a teacher. And then we went to stay with relatives in Sheffield. And when we arrived in Sheffield, they had the radio on, and there was this character called Wilfred Pickles, who used to be a BBC presenter, and he was at the school, at the refugee centre, interviewing all the wretched refugees from Canvey Island. And he said, we've got a little boy here now, we've got little Johnny Martin. It was the big figure, or the little figure, as he was then. He said, well, are you going to sing a song for us, Johnny? You know, we're going to sing. And Johnny Martin, big figure, sung Me and My Teddy Bear. So he was the first Dr. Feelgood to make it onto the airwaves, and that was all because of the flood.
And little Johnny Martin went on to become, as you say, the big figure. Yeah. That was his name in Dr. Feelgood, yeah, as the drummer in that band. Was there any jealousy that you weren't there taking part in the action, being interviewed by the late Wilfred Pickles?
Well, I mean, as I say, the island was evacuated. You had to leave, apart from people like my dad, who, my dad was a gas fitter, and he had to remain behind, I suppose, mending the gas pipes or whatever they do. And he was walking around chest deep in this freezing water. It was February. I mean, it was a tragedy. I mean, about 50 people were killed. It did my dad's chest in. Canvey Island then, in the wintertime, it always used to get misty. And his chest got worse and worse for 10 years, really. Every time the winter came and that, and the mist came, right, and he couldn't breathe and all that. And then eventually, after 10 years, it killed him. Now, that's my memories of the flood.
Let's have another question. This one's from Mikhail Mendez, who's from Uruguay and who plays bass in a band that does Dr. Feelgood covers. Mikhail.
Were the lyrics of Roxette, "I'm going to get your concrete mix and fill your back door up with bricks," inspired by the big figure because he was a builder at the time?
No. It was merely a random... is it a metaphor? No, it's a threat. we have a certain... Actually, Sparko was the bricklayer among us. I remember one day I did a day's hod carrying for Sparko, but Sparko is the laziest guy, I mean, the slowest bricklayer in the world, and so it was quite easy doing this hod carrying. He told me once, one morning, you know, these builders, they have to get up early. Sparko used to drive a Jag, and he said one morning he came out early in the morning to go to work, and he'd opened the boot of his Jag, and there were some blankets in there, and he thought, well, that's just nice, and he lay down. And then he was found there sometime later, fast asleep, hanging out of the back of his Jag. So that's as close to the building trade as I got.
Another question from the audience. This one's from Jerry Ranson, who says he works in London, but says he's still Essex at heart. Jerry.
Lyrics to your earlier songs with Feelgood perfectly encapsulate the band's boozer and betting shop image, which seems at odds with your own lifestyle as a teetotaler. Where did you get your inspiration from, and did you never feel a sort of urge to try something a bit different, like, say, Bowie did with Starman?
I thought you were talking about drinking then, when you said, did I get the urge to try something a bit different? I certainly did, and that was one of the bones of contention in the band, but we won't go into that. Sorry, what? I've forgotten what we're talking about.
Where did you get your inspiration, and did you ever feel an urge to try something different? Your love of astronomy, you could have gone to something like Bolan and Bowie were doing with Starman and stuff like that.
That's more like astrology, really. You know, there ain't no life on Mars, you know, we know that, don't we? Come on. In fact, there is a song called Underneath Orion, which features these constellations and things like that. But really, actually, the song is about I love you, baby, but you done me wrong. But you done me wrong underneath Orion.
Go on, how do you set that concept to music then?
Well, that one, I couldn't really do that one with the guitar, telling the truth.
Doesn't work.
Believe it or not, it was so progressive that I did it with a synthesizer. It had this thing going for it all the way. And I'm going on about, here I am, stuck out on the road, and I'm thinking of you, baby, and underneath Orion, and deep in the wintertime, underneath Orion, we parted, but we knew that someday we would meet again. Before I turned around to see the rising of the lion, I could hear you in the distance, baby, calling out your other lover's name. Cosmos.
Next question is from Roger Mann, and Roger says he saw the Feelgoods on the Geordie scene on television in 1975, and Wilco's guitar playing made a big impression. Like Wilco, Roger is naturally left-handed but plays guitar right-handed. Roger.
Wilco, you say in your book that you regret never making up with Lee Brillo before he died. Has your situation made you think about settling in any differences with anyone?
Yeah, there's a few people we're going to catch up with.
Settling differences, not scores.
Yeah. No, actually, I've thought about it, and I think that's why I do feel relaxed with the idea of death, you know, because I don't think I've got any outstanding issues or unfulfilled ambitions or unresolved things.
No regrets then, looking back through the career and the way that you forged your path through it. I mean, what is still a very difficult, was particularly at the time when you were setting out, a very difficult game in which to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, but Dr. Feelgood is so long ago to me now, it's like a dream, and it's a nice dream. And when I was in Kathmandu, if you'd have come up to me and said, you're going to spend your life as a musician, I would have gone, no, not even at all. And then when I got involved in it, you think, oh, well, this would be good for 4 or 5 years, you know. But now I've found that I have literally spent my life doing it. Probably best not to reflect too much on that, you know.
Many people from Essex in the audience for this edition of Master Tapes. Next question is from Duncan Boone. He's a specialist decorator by day, but by night is known as Bilko, playing your part in an Ian Dury and the Blockheads tribute band.
What was it like for you working with the late, great Ian Dury?
This is after the Feelgoods, of course, when you joined the Blockheads for a while.
I did indeed. Ian himself was a one-off. I mean, I love this guy. And, yeah, I have to say that he's probably one... No, not one of. The most offensive person I've ever met. I mean, he really could be rude to people. If he had had one drink too many, which is usually one, he would kind of sidle up to some innocent stranger and start destroying them, right? And he would like to wind people up into a state of spluttering fury and then win them over. It was his hobby, you know, and sometimes we were called upon to extricate him from problems. I remember one quite spectacularly. We were in Copenhagen. We were playing a big European festival. I'm in my room. I get this telephone call from the tour manager. Wilco, Ian's causing trouble down in the bar. Can you come down? And so I say, all right. I get down in the bar and there's Ian. He's got this poor American guy up against the wall. The American is freaking, right? And he's saying, listen, man, you know, I mean, I used to really respect you, but if you don't shut up, I'm going to thump you, you know? And I kind of get in between and smooth the American guy down. So I'm so sorry, man, I'm so sorry. You know, he's had one too many, you know? And then we think, right, we've got to get Ian back to his room. This bar had one of those rails around it, you know? And Ian was hanging onto this rail, and we said, we got out, and we're pulling him, man. And then he was hanging onto this rail, and he didn't want to leave the bar. We're going, come on, man, come on. We drag him out of the bar, and we got him to the lift. People coming into this smart hotel, you know, and there's this sight of this poor chap being dragged into the lift by three of the dodgiest looking guys, you know, and Ian shouting, help me, help me. And we got him in the lift, we got him up to his room, and the trick then is, you see, you throw him on the bed and took his caliper off of his leg, which means he can't stand up. And so long into the night we could hear him shouting, you're all sacked. So that was Ian Dury.
Let's move it on again. Next question is from Mark Lewis, yet another Essex man, yet another guitarist inspired by seeing you play with Dr. Feelgood in the mid-70s. Mark.
1975, Hammersmith Odeon. The night you walked off for 5 minutes and left them on their own. Do you remember that?
Ooh.
Yes. Everybody wondered what went on then. But anyway.
Did it look like a storm out in a fit of pique?
No, it didn't. He wandered off. I thought we might have been caught short. The three guys went through a sort of a 12-bar shuffle with Lee on the harmonica. Yeah. Then you come back on again, slapped Lee on the shoulder and carried on.
Yes, I was in a complicated mental state. And actually embarrassing and very, very unprofessional. Suddenly, I was standing on stage and I didn't know where, who or what I was. I'm standing thinking, what's happening here? I'm in some place, it's big, there's a lot of people, and go through one song and then another song. And after a while, I'm thinking, I'll tell you, this is too freaky, I've got to get off the stage. And so I remember walking to the side of the stage. And next thing I know, I'm over our minder's shoulder. He's carrying me up the stairs, right? Pushed me back on and carried on and finished the show. I think I've been awake for rather a long time.
Tired and emotional.
Yeah. Right. It was the last show of the tour, wasn't it? First big band I ever saw. That wasn't the question, by the way. The question was, Down by the Jetty, we'll get back to the album. Renowned for being an album with no overdubs or whatever. There's an instrumental on there, Mick Green's song, which was when he was with the Dakotas, if I'm not mistaken. That can't have had no overdubs on it, can it? Come on, Wilco. There must have been an overdub or two on that track.
Oh no! Absolutely.
Was that completely one thing?
No, I don't
want to incur his wrath.
No, no. In fact, that got on there because it was a number that we used to do live, and so Vic Mayall, the producer, said that he felt that we should put it on the album. And no, there's certainly no overdubs on it. It was just bashed out.
Can you remember it?
Yeah.
More to the point, can you play it now?
Yeah, go on.
As far as I can get.
Point proved, I think, Mark.
I'm impressed.
Thanks, Wilco. Just time for one final question in this edition of Master Tapes. It comes from Leanne Walsham, who's from Mersey Island in Essex.
Out of all the songs you've written, which is your favourite? And is it the favourite to perform live? If not, which one is?
At this point, these musicians normally say they're like children, you can't choose a favourite child.
I think it would have to be Back in the Night, because that one has always been popular, and because it's a very happy song, and playing that song, you usually get the feeling that there's a very happy feeling there, and if I ever do want to take a little bit of pride in what I do, it's I think, well, I have made quite a lot of people quite happy over the years, and that is one that always does it. So, all right, I'll say that one, Back in the Night.
Yeah. Are there any songs that you can't play anymore, that you just hate playing, that you've lost contact with, lost touch with?
No, I mean, a lot of them you just kind of forget, you know. No, I wouldn't say I've got bad relations with any of them, really.
You're on good terms with all of your songs.
Oh, no, my pals, my songs.
Wilco, thanks very much. That's all we've time for in this edition of Master Tapes. Thanks to our audience here at the BBC studios at Maida Vale. Thanks for all of your questions. But most of all, thanks to Wilco Johnson. Well, as Wilco gets ready to play us out, a reminder about the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can hear all of the programmes in this and the previous series, and exclusive live versions and videos of some of the songs we've discussed here at Maida Vale. And of course, you can always tweet about the programme using the hashtag Master Tapes. But we leave you now with Wilco Johnson playing us out with a solo version of the Dr. Feelgood classic, Roxette.
Can you hear that? They can't hear it. These are called loudspeakers. What you've got is actually soft speakers. One, two, can you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw you out the other night.
I saw you out the other night. I saw somebody hold you tight. Roxette. It was so dark I couldn't see, but I know it wasn't me. When I tell you it ain't right, I know you got to agree. I followed you into a show. The band was playing rock and roll. Roxette, I did not need to seek you out. Lord, the music played so loud, but I could hear you through the crowd, telling everyone about a new man you found. Roxette, I've got to go away and leave you for a couple of days. Roxette, I don't know more of your tricks. I'm gonna get some concrete mix, fill your back door up with bricks, and you better be there waiting get my business fixed. Yeah.
Six music.
Folk music has always been about the stories that people want to tell.
It was real life. And for a change, Hollywood stopped.
And Roy Harper has been telling those stories for his whole life.
I was trashed in the 80s. I wasn't punk. But as Johnny Marr says, that I was punk before the punks.
I'm Matt Everett, and this Sunday I talk to a true maverick. An inspiration to the likes of Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, John Peel, about the key moments of his music career.
It's a very powerful record. I think it was too ambitious for its age.
From his classic record, Stormcock, to starting out alongside Paul Simon.
He said, hey man, guess what? The record's number 16 in Boston. I said, oh, brilliant. I saw him 10 days later, and he said, hey man, the record's number one in Boston. I didn't see him for 4 years after that.
Matt Everett's The First Time with Roy Harper.
This Sunday afternoon from 1 on BBC Radio 6 Music.